some groups use soham in pranayama meditation. I've heard those words are not meant to be used like that, but do you think it's inauspicious to do that? Well, soham is a very sacred mantra. It means saha aham. I am that. Is I am Ishwara, saha aham. The soham, it's also frequently comes in some of the chants for the sannyasis, the soham. But I don't know what the pranayama meditation is used for or why it would be inauspicious. I have no idea why it would be considered inauspicious. I think what I do consider inauspicious is when these beautiful or sacred mantras are mispronounced or they're not understood and just maybe sung or something. It's just where there's not a respect for the tradition. But I don't see what's wrong with I don't know what a pranayama meditation is. I kind of don't know if a person is saying soham, soham, and pronouncing it properly, and even using the soham, there's no bija mantra there, the soham, I don't see what the problem would be, unless you're distorting the Sanskrit, and that's considered inauspicious, because in Sanskrit, depending on how the word is pronounced and what the appropriate swaras are, it can have a different meaning, so you don't really know what you're saying. Bhagavan could be listening to you and you're saying some weird thing that you don't mean to be saying. So in that way, you should you should know how to pronounce properly and you should know what the mantra means, I think. You know. But a caveat toward that is, in India, even when some of the pujaris are chanting all of these Vedic mantras, they don't always know what it means. Maybe a general idea what it means, but they've learned how to chant it properly. It's another level of education for a pujari to actually, or a brahmana who is really studying the Vedas. They can memorize the whole Vedas and just have it perfectly by heart, but not know the meaning. A whole another level is to actually know what you're chanting. So. That's why some of the chants, I'll ask different people, do you know what this means? And I don't always expect to get a yes answer. You may or may not know. So I don't know how else to answer. Yeah.
I think I've heard Vijaya Swami say that it's kind of silly to use that, because it's kind of like saying E equals MC squared, equals MC squared, equals MC squared, like that.
Well, say a person is saying soham and they don't know what the mantra means. Like if it means, say the mantra means, I am that. You don't know who the I is or the that is. So, I am what? So I am that. So in that sense, is that what you mean? It might be better to say, I am Shanti, or I am something that's meaningful to you. What else did he say?
I definitely remember the E equals MC squared, because I found that very funny. Because I picture somebody going, E equals MC squared.
is that how the meditation goes, like the...
Yeah, so on the inhale, and then hum on the exhale. Mm.
I don't know. That's not my tradition. That's not my tradition. I don't know anything about it. So
I always feel a little bit torn when I'm in situations like that, and also if it's bhajans and things, and like you say, it's mispronounced and all. Because it's nice to be there, and it's very devotional, and everyone means well,
mm-hmm.
and it's beautiful. But then, because I'm in this tradition and I know differently, or in my tradition is different, then I get a little torn. Like, is it going to be inauspicious, or is it fine to just join? And what's important? Like, I think I like to see it as what Ishvara hears is my intent, rather than if the words are not totally correct. When it's,
I think since you're in this particular tradition, which is a very kind of traditional tradition, that if somebody's doing something differently, you don't want to kind of raise your hand and say, you're not doing this correctly, and kind of ruin the whole evening. On the other hand, when you have a chance to teach the proper pronunciation, you know, and when you're teaching and leading a group, that you do it really properly, and then that is something that's going to be something that we have uphold in our tradition. So we just do it that way. There's no way to control the world, but we can make sure to kind of try to pass on the tradition as traditionally as possible and have a respect for it. And so, I mean, I'm positive that when you're doing, you're not going to be doing it like that because you won't be able to. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just sometimes I find myself in places, like if it's a singing, for example, Bad Johnson things, lots of Bad Johnson, and then comes out some Purnamadas.
And they sing that, yeah.
In this totally different way. And because...
Because the swaras...
I have, it's a little bit like, like I don't really feel like singing. At the same time, if I just let go of that, and then it's enjoyable.
I know, the thing is, when the swaras are there... Then that's Vedic, and so it's very important, actually, traditionally, that those be chanted, you know, properly, with the proper pronunciation, following the correct swaras, and all that's considered really proper. And you should not do it otherwise. But there's lots of chants and things that don't have swaras, and that's fine to do that. But the thing is that a lot of these things come over to this country without having any traditional knowledge attached to it, and so you'll hear all kinds of singing and everything like that. And it would be kind of shocking for a Hindu to hear that, and they wouldn't really probably appreciate it very much. But the Westerners that are doing it are innocent, but they're innocent because they don't have any knowledge. So we wouldn't do that because we know, and we're kind of very sensitive to what the Hindu sensibilities and being respectful and all of that, but other people would never think that they're not being respectful. They would have no idea. So you just have to let it be and let Bhagavan deal with it.
Would you sing along if you were in a place like that?
Mm-hmm. Probably.
You wouldn't accrue any popcorn, right?
No. if I was in that type of situation, I probably would. As opposed to sitting there like this. Or saying, I'd rather, because there's no bad intent. And sometimes you may get an opportunity to really explain, you know, to show the proper pronunciation of the swaras and teach people. I actually do that at CIS. I teach some chants properly. I teach them about Vedic chanting, about all of the swaras, and I teach them the Sanskrit pronunciation. I don't make them learn the script. I didn't go that far, but I did make them learn how to pronounce properly and to chant and to not sing like that. I explain all of that, and so that's what we can do, is we can kind of explain it when the opportunity is available to do that. That's what I think.
How do you recommend to sing and to do
bhajans? Bhajans don't really matter. But if there's not the swaras there, a bhajan can be sung really to any raga. There's really not a problem if you're singing a bhajan to your own in your own tune, and it's not Vedic and it doesn't have swaras, and it's to, you know, ragas, there are many, many different ragas. Bhajan that there is, you can sing that bhajan in many different ways, to many different ragas. You can experiment. In fact, when an Indian singing, if you have a raga, you can kind of do anything you want with it within those notes. It's very, very creative. So I would not worry about your singing a bhajan. But I would not sing a mantra that has swaras. Those are the tones, like if you go, Om Purnamidam, Purnamidam, those are swaras, those notes. Mm. the Swarita, Anudata, Udata. You know, you may have learned them out of, you know, I'm sure that either Sharada or Sunna will teach you, if you're taking the Sanskrit class, just point out what the swaras are. If something has swaras, then you need to chant that. You don't sing that. But so there's so many bhajans. I mean, a lot of the bhajans Swamiji wrote himself. That some of the things that we sing, he loves to write bhajans, and he would find the tune for it. And, of course, the tune that he would find would always be within the Indian raga system, because that's what he knew. You know, but say you make up a song or you're singing a bhajan, we can sing it beautifully. You don't have to worry. It's only if it's Vedic and it has swaras. Make sense? Yeah. We attribute positive emotions to Anandamaya kosha, not to manas. But I thought the koshas were a different way of classifying. I mean, the mind, including buddhi, citta, ahankara, and manas, are one way of classifying the koshas, another. Then it seems the positive emotions are not part of the mind at all. No. That's a good question. Okay, so let me work on that one. So, with the koshas are really, we can liken them to upadis. A kosha means a covering, something that's, a kosha is like a sheath, like the blade of, you know, a blade of grass has a sheath around it, that's a kosha. Or a knife has a sheath that the knife fits in, that's a kosha. And so here we say there's five koshas, and what we mean by that is really that they're not, the atma's not a little person inside with these koshas around it, as though there's some real physical thing. It's not like that. It's that the koshas act as a point of identification. Right? That's what they are. So there are five, and so a point of identification is called an upadi. So really the koshas are five, a way of categorizing the upadis. The upadis are those points of identification where the ahankara, the I notion, can land. Okay, so the first kosha, just to run through them, is called the Annamaya kosha. That kosha, which is maya, means comprised, composed of, made of food, annam. So this is made, it's the modification of food. Then the next one, Pranamaya kosha. The prana, that is the vital force that fills the body. Then we have the Manomaya kosha, which is, you know, when we have Manomaya and Vijnanamaya, the Manomaya is the manas, that type part of the mind, or that type of vritti. So I'll explain this in a minute, but just to go through it, so the manas. Vijnanamaya kosha is the buddhi, okay, and then Anandamaya kosha. So then all of those, the shariras can fit into these, the bodies can, subtle body and physical body can fit into these koshas, and even causal body can fit into the koshas. And then we can talk about the manas and the buddhi fitting into the koshas, the prana fits into the koshas, the physical body fits into the koshas. So it's just an interesting way of categorization. Now, we are interested right now in this koshas, in the Manomaya kosha and the Anandamaya kosha. Okay. It is not that common, and Swamiji, to my knowledge, never really talked about the Manomaya kosha being kind of the carrier, or in a sense, the one where the negative emotions were experienced. So he always, to my knowledge, and my maybe later, because I've never attended all of the later courses, he could have changed on this, but I never heard him change on it. He always looked at the Manomaya kosha as just the indecisive thought flow, where there was no clarity of thinking, there was no knowledge, there was only kind of thought flow and doubt. And also, we could also say that the impressions from sense perception would come into the manas also. That's sometimes said. Because the sense perception has to form a vritti. And so for that vritti, there's no decisive thinking. It's just simply a vritti. So we can give that to the manas, and that has frequently been done. But now, in the Viveka Chudamani, which is attributed to Shankaracharya, they are going through, and in not too far into it, I'd have to flip through the pages to find it. I was teaching it at one time, and I found this more lengthy description of the Manomaya Kosha, or the Manas, actually. And in that description, it was more than indeterminate thinking and thought flow. It was the negative emotions, because where to put those emotions? So what? In what they did, what Shankara did in this particular Viveka Chudamani, put the negative emotions in the Manomaya Kosha, and the positive emotions in the Anandamaya Kosha. So let me talk about first the Anandamaya Kosha, because that's really an interesting one, or one that we don't usually even think about in this way. When you have a vritti, an anandavritti, it's good. You have to think of it as a vritti, because this is a kosha, right? And so you have a bliss vritti, so some sort of happy vritti, some sort of vritti in which there is ananda or well-being or happiness or joy. And then that experience of happiness is momentary, right? So you have an experience of ananda, which is momentary. And so then at that time, when you're having that experience, you say, I am so happy. But then that experience goes away and your happiness goes away, right? So that's why it's a kosha, because I'm identifying with the experience that mind is giving me. So now, why is the Anandamaya Kosha different than, for instance, the buddhi, you know? Well, because at the moment of the Anandamaya Kosha, at that happiness experience, there really is no thought. There's an absorption of the mind because of the shanti, which could just simply be happening because you've fulfilled a desire, right? So at that moment, when the desire is filled at that moment, your mind is just free. It's free of any kind of desire. There's a shantavritti there, and it's filled with ananda. So that vritti being filled with ananda is what makes it an anandamaya kosha. That those kind of vrittis are classified as anandamaya kosha. In order for it not to be anandamaya kosha, you would have to be able to differentiate the happy vritti from the self, which is the source of that ananda, which you will be able to do, and you need to be able to do that, because otherwise you just think, oh, finally I'm experiencing myself. This vritti has come along, and now I'm experiencing myself, as though you're not there when all the vrittis are there. So this differentiation is extremely important, so that you are able to differentiate the ananda of your own being, which is ever-present. A vritti is not ever-present. And so this particular type of vritti, where I experience happiness or joy, which is, of course, momentary because it's there in the vritti, that experience of happiness or joy is called Anandamaya Kosha, and it needs to be differentiated from myself. That's why it's a kosha. And this is something that's really, I find for most people, really difficult, because they feel that the experience of ananda that we have in the mind, even though it's temporary, you know, that is me, you know. But it isn't me. It's my mind, as though reflecting me or manifesting me, but it is much different. That's why it lasts for a short period of time. It lasts as long as the vritti lasts, basically, you know, or the anuvrittis, the flow of similar vrittis, as long as that lasts, I have that experience. But also the experience of ananda for me is many and varied in terms of quality. It's on a continuum, and it just depends on the level of absorption to the mind. But what happens is it acts as a kosha, because I identify with myself. I am now happy, right? Okay, so that's anandamaya kosha. The buddhi is the one who has, what do you call, there's a word for it, but it's clear, stable, determinative knowledge. knowledge that you can act upon. You can have an idea of something, but it's doubt-filled. So a doubt-filled understanding is not knowledge. Knowledge means you have clarity and you can act on it. I used the example of going down the stairs and, did I lock the door? And say if I say that, did I lock the door? Okay, right now I don't know if I locked it. And then you say like this, yeah, I think I did. That's not going to fly. That's not good enough. Yeah, I think I did. I'm not really sure. I think so. But are you going to... If you go with that, what you're really saying is, you know, it doesn't really matter, so I'm going to leave. Yeah, I think I locked it. But you don't really know. That's not knowledge, you know. You have to say, yes, I clearly remember locking it. I know that I locked it. Then you can go. Otherwise, the only reason you can go is because you're really saying it doesn't matter anyway. I think I did, probably did, doesn't really matter. That's what that means. Yeah. So that's also a determination on the part of the buddhi, but the real determination there is, I'm leaving, it doesn't matter. Right? Right. Or what if you say, did I lock the door? Did I lock the door? I don't know. That's a determinative knowledge. I don't know. Okay. Therefore, I have to go and check. You can act on that. So even in terms of self-knowledge, you know, I think the Upanishads are saying this. Somehow they're saying that I'm all Ananda and all of this. It seems to make sense when Swamiji's talking, you know, but I don't really know. I don't really know, but it makes sense to me. I believe that, but I don't really know. That's not knowledge. Knowledge is that recognition, and you do know, and you don't have any doubt. And if somebody were to ask you, well, how do you know that? Then you can tell them. It's because of this, and this, and this, and this, and this. You have something to say. You know. You're very clear. You'll say it in your own way because you know. You know, that's knowledge. And so we don't put emotions in the buddhi, because when the emotions arise, we don't really know anything. They're either arising and they're overwhelming the buddhi. We have that experience where there's no buddhi there available to come and come into meaningful relationship with that. So the buddhi has to come into knowledgeable, clear relationship with whatever the experience is. So if they say there's thought flow, I can come in relationship to that thought flow, to the manas, you know. Or say I'm having emotions, I can come into relationship with those emotions, you know. But then I'm coming into the buddhi is coming into relationship with it from a determinative, clear position, you know. If it's overwhelmed by the manas, then I'm still clearly, I'm clear and definite with what I'm saying, but it's totally diluted, you know, delusion. Like it's diluted, moha. It's diluted by the emotion, but it's still acting decisively. We call that mithyajnanam. You're very clear, but what you're clear on is not correct. Right? So the buddhi also can be, you know, fooled. Yeah. But it's making clear, determinative decisions based upon its experiences, something like that. So you can, there's some wiggle room there, but you have to kind of understand how the buddhi works. The manas doesn't qualify for that. The manas is not talking in that way, you know. The manas is, the emotions themselves are something that are coming up as they're from the unconscious, usually. The emotions you can't generate yourself. The emotions generate themselves. They're triggered. You know, emotions are like given to you. And so they have nothing to do with the buddhi. They have nothing to do really with the citta. They have to do with the experience that is coming through. And so then we put those in the manas. We don't put the ananda, experiences of ananda, in the manas. Because when that experience is there, the mind is going into ashantavritti. You know, it has nothing to do with the fluctuating mind. It has to do with the ashantavritti that's there. It causes me to identify with the ananda that I'm experiencing and then feel sorrowful because it always comes to an end. You know. But when I have that experience, it It feels right. It feels like me. It feels like how I would like to be. I would like to be whole and complete and happy, you know. But this is a fluctuating happiness. It's the happiness that I experience in the form of a vritti. And then I take myself to be that, just like I take myself to be the sad vrittis, the emotional vrittis, right? So that's the idea with the koshas. So this, I think, I'm not, Swamiji did the 101 verses of Viveka Chidamani. But there's actually 300 or 400 or 500 verses. I'm not sure, 300-something verses in Viveka Chidamani. So I don't remember whether I studied that in the big Viveka Chidamani or in Swamiji's 101 verses. But I was really, gave it a lot of thought when I read that. And I was thinking, that's, I really liked it. It made a lot of sense to me. So I hope that's good enough. Please talk about suffering. What does it mean for a samsari, and what about for a jnani? Is there any sort of suffering still? I know we say that moksha is freedom from suffering, but I've also heard Radha say that Swamiji suffered a lot from his conditions at the end of his life. Thank you. That was physical suffering, and know that as long as you have a body, you are not free from physical suffering. You know, it's how you are toward that physical suffering that gives the mind some objectivity, you know. But it's not that the physical suffering isn't experienced. You know, in terms of emotional suffering, the emotional suffering is not going to be the same for a jnani and an ajnani. For emotional suffering has a reality. For an ajnani, it's suffering. We really suffer. I'm identified with the suffering, you know. There's not a self there that is kind of the inner friend of the one who suffers. That makes it totally different. So one thing, you know, like when Swamiji was really, you know, close to leaving us, he had these pictures of a picture of his father. Somebody had drawn a picture of his father. It was some sort of a siddhi, that this particular person had a siddhi where if you talked about because Swamiji had no memory whatsoever of his father. His father died when he was 8 years old. And so he really wanted to see a picture of his father. So they called in this special type of person who can, from descriptions, you know, and just being in the presence of people who know that person, can actually draw the face. And so I think Sheila or some of his devotees brought this person, and the person was able to draw just a small portrait, just of the head and shoulders like that, of Swamiji's father. And it really, there were a couple of people who had actually known his father, that were there, and they said, that is him, that looks just like him. So that picture was done. And then this man also drew a picture of Swamiji's mother, but there were a lot of pictures of Swamiji's mother, and, you know, but he drew her at a young age to match kind of the age of the father. And I knew Swamiji's mother, and it really looked exactly like her, but maybe 20 or 30 years before I met her, you know. But it's very obvious like her, there's no doubt about it. And the father, of course, you know, Swamiji had no memory. He died way before, I think, probably I was even born. I don't know. I didn't have any idea. But when Swamiji saw those pictures, so what they did was they put the pictures on the wall. And Swamiji was in his bedroom, and he was on a hospital bed, and he was looking out of the door into this little foyer where we used to go and meet him and have some little classes here. Only a few people could fit in that little room. He would study in that room, and people would come, and he would do his, you know, letter writing and all of that. Martha would come, and he would dictate to her, and all of that would go on. He would have a lot of board meetings and little meetings and things like that in there. So Swamiji his whole room was emptied out of all of his books and all. Now it was just a hospital room. So he had that hospital bed placed so that he could look through that door and see those pictures, you know. And so he was always looking at those pictures. And when I came, one of the first things he said to me, he said, "Did you see the picture?" I said, "No, Swamiji." So he said, "Look," and he pointed it to me. And he told me all about it, you know, that that was his father and who had come and drawn the picture and everything. You know, and so he showed it to me and talked about it a lot. And he said that when he saw that picture, you know, so many feelings and emotions came up, and images, all kinds of things that he had never had any access, and memories, all kinds of things that he had no access to, just bubbled. They bubbled up. Those are like kashayas, you know, things that were just stored there inside with no way to come out. All of a sudden, all kinds of different memories and feelings. He told me it was so amazing to have all of those feelings and memories rise up. And some of them may have been painful, but they would have also been joyous, you know, because they were things that he had no contact with because he lost his father at such a young age. It was a very, very profound experience. And so the point here is that for a jnani, when somebody dies who's very close to you, or, because I've experienced this with Swamiji, people have passed away that were very close devotees and people have been with him for years and that type of thing. So two or three, four instances of that. You know, it's not like you don't have any feelings. You know, you feel it. You feel it and it washes through you and it goes, you know. There's no one inside saying, "Why did this happen to me?" or "Why did he die?" You know, or "This shouldn't have happened. This is wrong." You know, that type of thing, and that's in any real way. One time, one famous singer that was very close to Swamiji, I wish I could remember his name. Now his son comes and sings all the time, but I knew his father. His father and a lot of his family members were just driving to give a concert, and they were killed in a car accident. The son remained, and so I remember I was there when we got that news, and Swamiji said something like, "Oh, so silly! How could this happen? He's so young, you know, so young and vibrant. Silly," something like that. I remember that, but there was nobody there to build up on it, you know, and then start wallowing in the grief. That's not what happens. The feelings rise, and as they should, you know, the feelings of grief, of love, they rise up and they go. And they go because there's nobody hanging on to them. And there's also nobody saying, "I shouldn't have any feelings." The feelings are innate. That the grief for a loved one is an innate, normal. It's normal. It's just that the jnani isn't going to build up on it. He'll just let that wash through. It's kind of, to use an example, it's kind of like a bird flying through the sky. You know, it doesn't leave any tracks. Right? It flies through the sky, and it's not carrying, doesn't carry anything with it like that. Another example, I like that example, but another example is these emotions are like riding on water. You know, if you write on water, there's all these ripples that go, and they just go and go. They're gone. Those are like what the emotions are, because there's nothing stored inside, so nothing's being triggered, because that's for the most part done, you know. And so they're pure. The emotions have a lot of beauty and a lot of purity. So is that enough? Okay, now, so I told you when Swamiji suffered from the conditions at the end of life was tremendous suffering, but that was physical suffering. He actually just bore that suffering. He never talked about it, really complained about it. He just was with it and accepted it, and, you know, we all experienced it with him from a distance. When we say that moksha is freedom from suffering, Moksha is self-knowledge. The self is free from suffering, even when suffering is taking place. Completely free from suffering. And so your experience when suffering takes place, or when experiences, any experience at all takes place, it is taking place, but you are free from it. And both are there. You are there, the one who is free, who is not suffering, who is ananda, and the experience, whatever it may be, is there. Both are there. But the one thing for certain is that if there's a suffering, or any type of suffering or whatever, that experience is not happening to the self. From the standpoint of the experience, there is suffering. I am suffering from the standpoint of the experience. But from the standpoint of me, I am completely free of suffering. So both of these things are there. The one who is free of suffering and the suffering, if there is suffering. See what I mean? So when you're talking about for this, for you there is no suffering, there's no suffering, and there never has been any suffering, and there never will be any suffering. But the jnani knows it and has differentiated that one who is totally free from all of that. That's your nature. So. Can one say Mityananda would be the subtle experience of being completely loved while understanding the nature of the experiencer? I think I use that word Mityananda. It's kind of facetiously, but can one say that Mityananda, how about this? Mityananda is this Anandamaya Kosha. That's what it is. Because there's Ananda there, and you take yourself to be that. So I think that completes it. You identify with the Ananda Vritti. Can you illustrate the differences between an Ajnani feeling sad versus Ajnani experiencing sadness? Thank you. For the Ajnani, I am the sadness. I am sad. And I mean that I am sad. For the Jnani, I'm never sad. The mind is having a vritti, which is sad, so I'm experiencing that sadness, and I'm also experiencing my freedom from that sadness, which is quite different. And also for the Jnani, and for some Ajnanis also, for the Jnani, there's no real build-up on the sadness or on any vritti, really. It just is what it is. And then I don't say, the why-me network, you know, web, doesn't take place. Or how could this happen to me, or how could he do this to me, or whatever it happens to be, this web that I can build around it with thousands of other vrittis that make it into kind of a solid structure, you know, that I find myself encased in. That doesn't happen. Because I have that vairagya, I've had time to mature. Also, remember when we're talking about now that we're in the section where Krishna is describing the jnani, how the jnani thinks and feels. He's describing it in detail, and as you'll see as we go on, he's describing what is natural for you when you have the jnana nishtha, and until you do, what is your sadhana, so that you have these values and these understandings so that you can, what Swamiji will say, jokingly but not joking, is, you know, you fake it till you make it. But that's just a Western phrase, fake it, kind of a funny phrase, fake it till you make it. It rhymes and everything, so it's fun. But you're actually not faking it. Say if you have a value for compassion, that's what you value, but you're feeling not very compassionate. So you choose to follow and act out of your value than out of your feeling that you, the feeling that you don't value, you know. So say you have a value. It's all of them are all the same. So you have a value for, you know, for kindness and for kindness, and yet you feel a feeling. Some the thoughts that you're having for a person, if you were to speak them out, that would actually be really unkind, you know, or your unwillingness to make, to include or to make room for a person because you don't like them or something. So that's all of that type of thinking doesn't go along with our values. You know, even though we can have those emotions and feelings because the person's irritating or whatever, doesn't like you or whatever it is, And so you want to kind of just push them out of the way, but you'll never feel good doing that. You think that it'll be better because you've eliminated them, but then you'll always realize what you did. And it's not dharma, it's not right. And so then you'll have to live with that until you correct it somehow. You have to go correct it, you know? And so you end up as a sadhana, even though sometimes it can be hard, you know, to act out of your value of kindness, even though you're not feeling kind. Your value of caring, even though you're not feeling very caring, you know. What should take precedence, that you're not feeling caring, or your value for being a caring person? For us, it's the value of being a caring person. And until I'm spontaneously, naturally a caring person, I will act as a caring person, you know, and to neutralize this other way of being, which I don't value, which I don't want to be. So it's not faking it. It's a choice to act out of what I believe in, what I value, rather than following these emotions that can rise out of all kinds of complexes. I mean, you know, sometimes the emotions we really don't, the emotions that come out of our complexes, like sometimes, you know, lots of hurt or rage or hatred or whatever, so many things can come out. You don't want to choose those to act out on. You want to choose those to work on, you know. So that fake it till you make it, when you really understand what it means, it's really very, very beautiful and very helpful to your own antakarna shuddhi, what you actually want and need to really have the mind just bask in this knowledge. Your mind has to relatively be what you absolutely are, you know. And, yeah. So all of those positive emotions are natural expressions of myself when I don't have complexes and hurts and samsara. I'm hurt in this way and this way, and my raga dveshas are all thwarted in this way and this way by this person and this person. All this, blah, you know. There's lots of stuff going on. So we have to sort through all of that. It seems to me that if we are to become jnanis in this lifetime, that would be written in our prarabdha karma. How set in stone is an event such as this? Thank you. That's interesting. I think that there is in the charts often some things that are conducive to moksha. I don't think there's something that, I'm not sure that there's something that says, definitely you will be liberated in this life. Just sit back, don't do anything, it'll all happen, no problem. Yeah. But the life can be your chart, as the chart speaks, it can be very conducive to that. And then sometimes the astrologer will say, it's very conducive to moksha. And then it's very conducive to liberation and to living, you know, maybe a sannyasa life or living a very spiritual life. And some people will go, oh no. What about getting married? What about having children? What about making money? You know, because that kind of chart is an anathema in a way, like when parents have the chart done for their child, the child's just born, and the astrologer reads and says, ah, it looks certain that your child is going to be a sannyasi. I go, what a wail and cry. Because what about my grandchildren? You know, what about my grandchildren? Who's going to take care of us? And all this, really. You know? So they love and respect sannyasis as long as their child doesn't become one. That's a big joke in India, actually. They all laugh about it because it's so pervasive and because it's true, you know. And they know that. And they know how much they admire and need to have in their life a guru and a sannyasi, and all that. They have so much respect as long as it's not my child. You know? So, yeah. Funny because Swamiji, all of his family became devotees. All of his brothers became devotees of him. His brothers were, and they did a lot of seva for him. They helped him with so much of his work, to aim for Seva. One brother is really in charge of that, Srinivasan. Another brother, Ramachandran, really ran everything that was going on in Manjikuti, which is Swamiji's hometown. He took care of all of that. Swamiji built a lot of schools in his town, you know, schools for all ages of kids. He put in a hospital there. So many wonderful things. Some things were little nursery schools for little tiny children. And I visited there once, and they took me to all these little schools, and I sat with the little children, and they gave demonstrations of, you know, their English and all of that. And it was so cute. And then we talked also to the older children. Some, I think, were like in 7th, 8th grade. And Edward was there with me. So Edward and I and then Ramachandra, his brother, we went to meet the children. And there was a sea of children. Just, there must have been maybe 2,000 children there. And just, you look, you know. And they had been waiting for us. And so then we both of us talked to them for a while and all of that. And they stood up, all 2,000 of them. I'm serious. I think it's probably about 2,000. It's a really huge sea. They're all dressed exactly the same. So they all stood up together and they chanted some, you know, some chants, and they also repeated the Indian, what do you call it, like anthem. And they sang that, and they sang some chants, and they did some nice things for us. It was sweet. And then we went to the high school kids. We went to another place, the high school kids, and there was maybe 200 of those kids. And so I just asked them, because I just saw, you know, said, how many of you want to come to the United States? And everyone goes, well, I do. I do. And so then I told them, I hope you can all come, but I hope you bring your knowledge. I hope you bring this knowledge with you. And I gave them a little talk like that. It was wonderful. So anyway, maybe there's something written in the Prarabdha that you don't have to worry about it because you're here. And if you're not here, it's because you have no interest in it, so it's definitely not in the Prarabdha at all. So it's all's well. Oh, could you please unfold Pratipaksha Bhavana? I should have... Yes! Okay. This has to go on the top. It has to go... Okay. But I'm going to talk about it because we've got a few minutes. I'll talk a little bit about it and I'll keep it in here again. It's not that hard. Pratipaksha Bhavana has to do with neutralizing my feelings and actually transforming them into the opposite. The word Pratipaksha means the opposite. Paksha, the word Paksha means a wing, like the wing of a bird. So on the one side, this here's one wing, and here's the other wing, you know. And so if this wing is, I hate you and I really can't stand you, the opposite wing is going to be, I see a lot of good in you and I like you. Okay, so. Okay. So you have to bring in the other wing. So the opposite. You bring in the opposite emotion. And so Swamiji always tells different stories around this Pratipaksha Bhavana. Or say, for instance, and I think I quickly kind of told the story a little bit. You know, if say the boss, your boss that you're working for, is really kind of he's really a grouchy and mean and nasty, you know, and it makes everybody's life difficult, and you really, really don't like him, and so you don't like who he is, you don't like the way he talks to you, you wish you had nothing to do with him, you wish you didn't work there, he's a terrible boss, you really don't like this guy at all. And so, this is what you carry around with you. You go home, and what do you think? Oh, I can't stand this guy. Get up in the morning, what do you think? I cannot stand this guy. I don't even want to have to go and see him. I can't stand his face. And so, you need a little Pratipaksha Bhavana. You need that. Because you're carrying this one side of the wing that's causing you a lot of pain. You know, I told you this one author named Fred Luskin. He says, it's taking up way too much real estate. This guy could care less whether you like him or not. You know, he could care less. You are taking up no real estate in his mind. But he's overwhelming yours. And so we really have to neutralize this. And so what you do, either on a subtle level, a mental level, internally, or externally, you take an action that is the opposite of how you feel, right? And that could be the example Swamiji uses is you offer to this fellow a rose every day. Say you had a small vase and you put a beautiful rose in that, and every day you brought it to him and you put it on his, you know, you put it on his desk. And you just keep doing that every single day. You could even say, "Good morning, sir. Nice rose for you." Okay, you offer this rose every day. You don't have to do much. You just do an action which is the opposite, you know. And after a while of doing that, there is almost invariably a shift that takes place. It can even take place right away because you're making a positive action that makes a little crack in your mind, in this wall. It sets a different path, you know. And so, but how Swamiji did it, this fellow brought the rose every day and brought the rose. And after some time, the man became softer toward him. And there started this wall of disdain started to just kind of melt until he was no longer holding it inside this pretty picture bottle. You can do it internally also. Like say there's somebody that it's just a really painful relationship and you carry it around with you. The person can even be on the other side of the world and you're still carrying that painful relationship. You can internally do that pratipaksha bhavana, you know, by saying something imaginally, either saying something nice to that person or offering a rose or talking about to that person the beautiful things you see about them. Because it's always there. It's just when you're overwhelmed with the negative, you don't see. But if you look for it, you can see. And so by doing that, bringing in the opposite, you neutralize this negative force inside you toward the situation or this person. So that's a pretty picture bhavana. You can do it internally or externally. And I think I've told the story several times about that one person who there was just a really awful relationship that I had when I was teaching the course that we did in Piercy, California, a three-year course. There was someone there who had a very painful relationship with. It was just awful. It was just, there's a lot of kinds of jealousy and all kinds of stuff going on. I felt, you know, just stay away from me. See, the jealousy is very hard to deal with. If somebody's jealous of you, you know, then they just really don't like you because you're in their way. Not anything to do with you, you're in their way. And it was just this awful, awful relationship. And this guy felt really crimped by it. And some other things, anyway, was awful. And then I was carrying all these awful feelings around with me. You know, and Swamiji kept saying, "You have to go up and you have to say something. Just go up, say something nice. Just say something nice and leave. That's all." Because he knew. He knew. That's pratipaksha bhavana. You're doing the opposite. And it's very hard sometimes. Even internally to do it can be very hard. You just don't want to. No. You know? And that's how I was. No. Swamiji, no. Yes. Yes, you must do this. So it took it three or four times of insisting. He really insisted. And I was saying, "I can't. I cannot." You know, it's like that. That was pretty bad, you know. But I finally did. I finally did it. It took a lot of strength and courage on my part also to do that. And whatever that huge knot was just went whew, like that as I walked away. That's the miraculous nature of it. Once you learn how to do it, then I think I've told you things came back and whatnot, but I just did it again. And then for me it became easy to do that. It became a tool, an easy way to break through some sort of complex or negative overwhelm that you have that you know, is just kind of there, and that's not what you want for yourself or for anybody. And so now that's a net pratipaksha bhavana is another beautiful tool to be able to neutralize that and disperse it. So So that's like when we're doing all of this inner child work and like sitting in front of somebody we don't like or bringing the image of somebody that we don't like and all these things that we're learning, these are tools. Tools, ways of transforming my mind so that I'm breaking through these negative things so that my mind just is naturally expressing my values. The values that are, by that I mean the values that are natural to the self, like love and kindness and care and compassion and, you know, sympathy and the whole positive spectrum of values. Those are me. That's who I am. And that's the natural expression of my being. And so when I'm not that way, I don't feel good about it. It doesn't feel good at all. It's very, very uncomfortable. And so, but we have to realize that, and then we have to be willing to do the work to neutralize those things, because all of those things have been built up in our days of self-ignorance, you know? So now we have to work on those things to neutralize them, and said another way. And you use these tools for a while, they become yours, and it's just what you do. And then your mind, you know, starts just becoming the mind that is your mind, rather than the mind that is a result of these hurts and emotions that are really generated by self-ignorance. Because your mind is really, your mind, the mind that Bhagavan gave you, is really a very pure, beautiful mind. You know? But now it has to handle. And it's also, he also, of course, gave us the inner equipment to handle and store away all of these complexes that we have because of the self-ignorance. Yeah.
But if you do that, if you have the opposite feeling and you're saying the opposite, wouldn't it be confusing for the other person if they sense that this not?
Well, if you feel like it's not exactly a lie, though, like say, when like the thing that I did. It wasn't going up and saying, "Oh, I like you so much." I don't even know. They would just look at me like I was crazy. You don't like me. You're lying, you know. But that's not what I mean by pratipakshabhavana. It is doing an act. My action was to walk by and say hello. That was a big thing, though. For me to do that, that was hard. I just walked by and said hello. Like I would say to any of you, "Hi, how are you?" You know? That's not a big thing. But for me, with that person, it was a big thing. But it was not a lie, you know. So you find something to say that is not a lie, but you nevertheless wouldn't do it because it's too hard to do. So you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise they'll look at you and think, Doing an action is not a lie. Like if I decide to put a flower, for this particular person, if I put a flower, of course if I did that because she knows Swamiji too, she would say, "Oh, pretty picture Bhavana." And then I'd say, "That's right." Yeah. It would probably work fine. I'd go, okay. It's not like she was innocent. She didn't have any problems. She'd probably start, if I'd done that, she'd probably start bringing me a flower too. Okay. Why don't we do just one budget? Just one. To go to bed on. Yeah, a bhajan for bed.
Jai Jai Govinda Jai Hari Govinda.
Jai Jai Govinda Jai Hari Govinda.
Jai Jai Govinda Jai Hari Govinda. Jai Jai Govinda Jai Hari Govinda.
Jai Jai
Govinda Jai Hari Govinda.
Jai Jai Govinda Jai Hari Govinda.
Jai Jai Govinda Jai Hari Govinda.
Jai Jai Govinda Jai Hari Govinda.
Govinda Jaya Hari Govinda. Jai Jai Govinda Jaya Hari Govinda. Jai Jai Govinda Jaya Hari Govinda. 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 Hari Govinda. 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 Swasti prajapya paripalayantam Nyayena margena mahim mahishah Go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu Kale varshatu parjanyah Prithivi sasya shalini Desho yam shobahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kashchit dukha bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityor ma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.